If you would, open up to Matthew chapter 20. Nothing like coming in middle conversation, huh? So as we've already covered the first 19 chapters through the last couple of years, so moving forward, whenever you think about the Gospel of Matthew, who do you think of the audiences being that Matthew is really writing to? Who do you think of? Jewish people, encouragement for those who are believers, a movement for those who maybe were being introduced to Jesus and these writings for the first time. Yet very specifically, as you go through the Gospel of Matthew, so often you're going to read a passage and then run into a quotation from the Old Testament. Why does it do that? Continuity? You think about for Jewish people who had full faith in the Old Testament, what we think of as the Old Testament, and going, see, Jesus really is the king that had been prophesied. He really is the Messiah, specifically the way he's introduced in chapter 1. He is fulfilling all of those prophecies. So if you were faithful, a faithful Jew under the Old Covenant, this should become crystal clear about who Jesus is. Now, you come here to chapter 20, and I want to do things just a little bit different this morning. Let's read down through together the first 16 verses of Matthew chapter 20. And then I want to ask you a few questions as we get to the end, because I feel like this is a rather familiar story to us. It may not be, but we'll look at things a little bit better that way. But look at verse 1. For the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. When he had agreed with the laborers for a denarius for the day, he sent them into his vineyard. And he went out about the third hour and saw others standing idle in the marketplace. And to those he said, you also go into the vineyard, and whatever is right I will give you. And so they went. Again, he went out about the sixth and the ninth hour and did the same thing. And about the 11th hour he went out and found others standing around. And he said to them, why have you been standing here idle all day long? They said to him, because no one hired us. He said to them, you go into the vineyard too. When evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to his foreman, call the laborers and pay them their wages, beginning with the last group to the first. When those hired about the 11th hour came, each one received a denarius. When those hired first came, they thought that they would receive more. But each of them also received a denarius. When they received it, they grumbled at the landowner, saying, these last men have worked only 1 hour, and you have made them equal to us who have borne the burden and the scorching heat of the day. But he answered and said to one of them, friend, I'm doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for a denarius? Take what is yours and go. But I wish to give to this last man the same as to you. Is it not lawful for me to do what I wish with what is my own? Or is your eye envious because I am generous? So the last shall be first and the first last. When you hear this parable, what overwhelming thought do you see Jesus trying to get through to the listeners? If you had to sum it all up and just one thought, what do you think Jesus is trying to get across to the listener? All right, same chance. Karen? And you think in terms of longevity is not what decides the wage. Susan, you look like you had something on the tip of your tongue there. 19. Now, if you look back at 19, he says, but many who are first will be last, and the last first. And Jesus had just been talking about, well, what about if we lose our farms, or what about these things? And going, are you willing? And this first and last theme begins in chapter 19, goes through here in verse 20, verse 16, and you're going to see it even further on down in chapter 20 and verse 26. Is it not this way among you? But whoever wishes to become great among you shall be your servant, first and last. You kind of see this theme. Lynn. And the Gentiles. That's a good thing looking back on it, isn't it? And to go for them at that point, they're still thinking, Gentile. Whoa. But you kind of see how that would play together with that idea, with what's coming in the book of Acts. So you look at all these things together. Out of the, I'm going to call them five different shifts. There's the first shift, which comes in. Then you get a 9 o'clock shift, a noon shift, a 3, and a 5 in our time. Now, I'll go ahead and tell you this. How chapter 20 is laid out is just the way you might imagine. It is Jewish time that it's using to keep it. In Jewish time, if you imagine the sun rising at 6 a.m. and the sun setting at 6 p.m., they counted each one of those as 1 hour of time. From 6 a.m. to 6 p.m. They didn't really count on when it comes to like the night hours. That wasn't really part of their idea. So for them, they would divide that up into 12 equal times. So when it says, if you notice it in verse 1, it says, they went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. I mean, you're talking about like 6 or 7 o'clock in the morning. I mean, this is early. And I know for all of us, early is a different time that we might imagine on the clock, and sometimes based upon different times of our lives. But at the same time, to realize, as he brings these things about, to go 6 o'clock, 9 o'clock, 12 o'clock, noon, and then 3 o'clock, 5 o'clock, and 6 o'clock would be sunset. So you understand, those that are hired, they only work 1 hour. They're hired at 5 o'clock. They work until 6. So it is just 1 hour of the day. So you see how these things kind of work together. Here's what I want you to really pay close attention to. Now let's take some time and go through it. Now, another idea here, if you think about those five different, and I call them shifts, but you know it's not that. They're not just working for little increments of time. They start when they start, and then they finish out the day. Which one of the groups would you want to be in? Isn't that something? Not too many people go, I want to be the 9 o'clock group, or I want to be the first group. So oftentimes we go, if I just come in, I get to work for an hour, and then I get paid. This sounds like the great way to do it. But I'm going to lead you into some things that maybe might make you think a little bit different about that. Now, let's just kind of start back at verse 1, and now kind of start to build some things. We already know the whole story, but let's take a closer look. So verse 1, for the kingdom of heaven is like a landowner who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. Now, a couple of things. What's the real comparison? Kingdom of heaven, which kingdom of heaven is a Matthew phrase. In the other gospel accounts, you'll see the kingdom of God. Matthew is just set up a little bit different on how it uses that. So we're talking about the kingdom of heaven, and it's compared to a landowner. Now, in this story, with it being a parable, who is the landowner? God is. And notice, where is he sending these laborers to work? In his vineyard. All right. Now, I know you're just super familiar with every vineyard and all the practices and labor that goes into that. But I want you to tell me, whenever you think about going to work in a vineyard, what kind of jobs do you imagine? Picking grapes? Smashing grapes? Pruning the vines? Weeding. Oh, the joys of weeding. Joys in the kingdom of weeding. Anybody think about planting a vine? Say it louder. And you, sometimes even in terms of irrigation, having to draw water from wells. I mean, that'd be tough. I mean, you're talking about that's a lot of water. you start going through and thinking about what does it take even in terms of preparing a vat to where you can actually crush the grapes and get the juice. Other grapes might not all be actually turned into juice. What would they do with other grapes? Eat them fresh? Others, they might allow to what? Yep, might turn them into something else, some other product of the grape. Realize some of them, they just dried out on the vine and they turned into raisins. So you realize also in having to go through and cultivate ground, having to even, for some of them, having to graft in vines into the main vine as they're there, you realize this is a lot of labor. And it takes a lot of work and a lot of sweat. And at the same time, what about the tools that you're using? Where do those come from? You might have to smelt out metal to be able to forge tools, all these kind of things. Bam. Right. And you think in those terms of going, what does it tell you about the time of year it is in the story? It's scorching hot in the middle of the day, and it does not go unnoticed. I mean, take this week. Kind of similar, isn't it? Going to be, I mean, heat indexes of over 100 degrees today. And you start to notice this picture and go, kingdom of heaven compared to a landowner being God. And then it says he goes out early in the morning. And I imagine that 6 to 7 a.m. time frame. If you want to imagine something different, you could be just as right as I am wrong. Then he says early morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. Notice hire. Whenever you think about being hired, how does that go? Talking about a wage. Now, I know this could go both ways. How many of you have signed up for a job that you would have for a year or more and not known the wage before you started the job? Usually that's the way it goes, right? There's a little some kind of advertisement looking for help. Someone shows up. Big questions. What do you want me to do? What are the hours? How much does it pay? And it may not come in that order. It's just kind of the way the agreement works, right? And to realize, is that anything new? No. So, verse 2. When he had agreed with the laborers for a denarius for the day, he sent them into his vineyard. Now notice, he is not currently in the vineyard. He is going out to find laborers. We'll find here in a minute that some are in the marketplace. But he hires them, and it says, and he made an agreement with them. I'll give you a denarius, which is typically considered to be a day's wage. And you start going through that. If you kind of want to make a personal application, you know, take whatever your best salary was for a week and divide it into seven, and then that's about what you're talking about. So for everybody, that's a little different picture. I know growing up, I used to think, okay, if you can make $100 a day, that was great. But to realize times are so different and money values are so vastly different now. But here's what I want you to see. They agreed. Whenever you hear agreement, what do you think of? Acceptable on both sides. Contract kind of idea. Notice it doesn't say anything signed here, but they just agreed. And in my mind, I think, it doesn't say that, but that's just kind of my idea. So a day's wage, we've agreed. You're going to work in my vineyard. I'm the one who owns the vineyard. He says, and he sends them. Notice it says, and he sent them into his vineyard, which tells you he gives them directions about where that is or whatever that goes with it. Verse 3. And he went out about the third hour. So we're talking about 9 o'clock in the morning. And saw others standing idle in the marketplace. So where is the landowner now? He's in the marketplace. Doesn't really tell you where he found these other people who are who are out and about at 6 to 7 a.m. But now he comes to the third hour, it's 9 o'clock in the morning, and people are just standing around idle. He says, do you think he's going to hire them to be idle in his kingdom? No. And so notice how he puts this together. He says, verse 4, and to those he said, you also go into the vineyard, and whatever is right I will give you. Now, what's different about this second group? They don't have an agreement. He says, you go and work. Go ahead. Yep, he finds them idle there in the marketplace, and he says, you also go into the vineyard. And he says, and whatever is right, I will give you. No agreement. But do these people understand who this landowner is? In some way. I want you to think about people that you trust in your life. You go, okay, hey, could you pick up, the other day I was talking to somebody on the phone. They were at a marketplace where I was going to have to go later, and I didn't take them up on the offer. But they said, well, you want me to pick something up for you? And they didn't say, you want me to pick it up for you, and then you'll reimburse me for what I buy for you? Whenever you know somebody and you understand the relationship, do you have to have everything agreed to? They're willing to trust the landowner. They're willing to say, whatever is right, I will give you. And what did they do? Was that good enough for them? So they still had a choice as to whether they went or not. And that's good enough for them. It says, whatever you say is right. And then off they went. Now, verse 5. Again, he went out about the sixth and the ninth hour. Now we're talking about 12 o'clock for the ninth hour, or for the sixth hour. You think about 6 a.m. plus 6 gets you to noon. It says the sixth hour, which is noon our time. And the ninth hour, 3 o'clock p.m. in the afternoon, and did the same thing. He found other people along the way. And I want you to kind of notice what he says here. He went out and said, you also go into the vineyard, and whatever is right I will give you. What were they willing to accept? Whatever is right in your eyes, we're willing to go work for. They didn't say, well, I'll work for half a denarius. I'll work for three quarters of a denarius. They say, whatever's right, we know you, that's sufficient. We'll go work for the rest of the day. And to realize, too, if you start at 9 o'clock in the morning, how long are you working if you work till 6? 9 hours. Oh, just whatever's right, that's fine with me. The group that comes in at noon, how long will they be working? 6 hours. The ninth hour group, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, they're only working for 3 hours. Whatever's right. Okay, well, we'll go do that work. Then, verse 6. And about the 11th hour, we're at 5 p.m., which is really kind of a nice time of day to work if the sun's going down at 6. He says, he went out and found others standing around. Now, once again, do you notice what the landowner is doing? He's looking. He's searching. I mean, notice, he goes to the marketplace. He goes out early. He goes out at noon. He goes out at 3. And now, even at the 11th hour, he finds some people standing around. And he said to them, why have you been standing here idle all day long? And he says, why did you not do something? And look at how honest they are. I want to take it as honesty, at least. Verse 7, he says, they said to him, because no one hired us. Why have you been here idle all day? Nobody hired me. I mean, it's just kind of funny sometimes. I remember one time getting into a situation, and I was holding a meeting at one place, and this older man, he really wasn't as old as I'm imagining telling the story, but I'm not going to give you a real number. And so he was really angry one night. I could tell just by look on his face. And I thought, what's going on here? And he came to me after I'd been teaching, And he said, you've been coming here for like 10 years. How come you've never come to where we are? I said, I've never been asked. And he goes, oh. I thought, okay. And everything was great after that. But you just kind of notice sometimes the situations that we read into things, but here they are. He says, why have you not done anything? Well, we haven't been hired. No, nobody hired us. And he said to them, you go into the vineyard too. I mean, you think, last hour of the day? Then, verse 8, when evening came, now there's your 6 o'clock p.m. So we've completed it. When evening came, the owner of the vineyard, oh, notice who's showing up at the vineyard now. Now here's the landowner. He says, here he is. The owner of the vineyard said to his foreman. Now, here's a foreman. How long has this foreman been here? He's never been mentioned until this point. But this tells you why the landowner can just say, go to the vineyard. And almost wondered if he had the name of the foreman specifically to go, just tell him that you're there to work for the rest of the day. Here's the foreman. Now, I'm not 100% sure what to do with the foreman. I know I want to think of the foreman a little bit as Jesus, of being the mediator. That seems to fit. But I'm not sure that's necessarily the direction this is going. So just be careful with that. Since the owner of the vineyard said to his foreman, call the laborers and pay them their wages, beginning with the last group to the first. Now, this whole story would be completely different if he said, just pay the laborers that came first, and then we'll pay the laborers that came last. And by the time we get to them, those first group will all be gone, and they won't have anything to complain about. But he doesn't do that. He's got a point to make. Now, tells the foreman, call the laborers, not the idlers, but the laborers, pay them their wages, beginning with the last group to the first. Verse 9. When those hired about the 11th hour came, each one received a denarius. They got a whole denarius. They worked for probably less than an hour because it takes a little time to get there. And by the time you get there, you got to get some instruction. And then you do the work, and then all of a sudden, hey, it's over. Call everybody in, time to get paid. This is great. So, sure enough, gives them a denarius. Verse 10. When those hired first came, they, here's the big key word, thought. They thought that they would receive more, but each of them also received a denarius. They had already agreed. They're the only group that we know of in all of these five different groups that actually had an agreement with the landowner. Now, here's the curious part. They saw, notice, they were there to witness those who had just shown up for the last hour. These probably would have been the folks I think of in our term. These are the folks they might not have known by name because they just showed up. Or maybe they were people they knew all along in their lives from earlier. But anyway, you come around and you go, we know that they were just here for an hour. And if they're getting paid a denarius, we know what we'd agreed to. Yeah, we're going to get paid more. Because it wouldn't be fair if they got paid the same thing as we did. Now, how are they thinking about fair? In human terms. They're not thinking in terms of we agreed, however that agreement happened. Do we ever do that? Do we ever start to estimate that we should get something different based upon what's going on rather than looking and going, that's what I agreed to. I said I would do that. Now, notice how it continues on. He says, verse 11, well, rest of verse 10. When those hired first came, they thought that they would receive more, but each of them also received a denarius. They got exactly what they agreed to. Isn't that what agreements are for? That you get what you agree to? I mean, whenever you are working your salary job, do they just go, you know what, I know we agreed to pay this wage. We just want to give you an extra $10,000 this year. And you realize there's some aspects of that, Nancy. They don't. That's a good point. They don't know about what's been worked out with those groups. Because in order to figure that out, what would they have to do? They'd have to ask a question. But what did they decide to do rather than ask a question? They decided, well, look at the next verse, verse 11. Here's what they decided to do. He says, when they received it, they grumbled at the landowner. They didn't decide to ask a question. They decided they would rather grumble about it. Now, and notice, who do they grumble against? Landowner. They don't grumble against the foreman. They grumble against the landowner. Now, remember what this comparison's all about? Kingdom of heaven would be compared to a landowner. Does anybody grumble against God? Marlene says they shouldn't. But does that stop everybody? Historically, we have. Now, you realize this, do they really have anything to be angry about? Has the landowner treated them according to the agreement they made? He has. Now, I want you to notice something here. It says, when they received their denarius, they grumbled at the landowner. And verse 12 is going to tell you, and what did that grumbling sound like? The Greek word for grumble literally means low tone. It's low tone. It's one of those things that you say under your breath to somebody who's beside you. It's one of those things that that happens when all of a sudden there's this big, maybe you're at a group event or something and somebody makes some statement that you feel like is outlandish and you lean over to the person next to you and go, yeah, that's craziness. But you realize here, their grumbling sounds like this, verse 12. These last men have worked only 1 hour, and you have made them equal to us who have borne the burden and the scorching heat of the day. How does the attitude of their heart sound? Sour, bitter, hardened? Now, notice this is kind of an interesting one because they're not necessarily just leaning across and talking to their neighbor. Notice how the pronouns work. These last men have worked only 1 hour, and you have made them equal to us who have borne the burden and the scorching heat of the day. He says, we had to go through things they didn't have to go through. I've had to go through a lot, is the way they make it sound. Now, here's something else I want you to kind of pick up on. You see this word for grumble? It's actually, I think you'll hear the English word and the Greek word. Gong uzo. A gong makes what kind of sound? A pretty low tone, right? Boom. Now, it kind of catches everybody's attention, doesn't it? Do grumblers and complainers catch people's attention? Yeah, a lot of times for the wrong reason. But here's what I want you to see. Here they are. I'm going to show you what's missing. Now hold your place here. We're going to come back to Matthew chapter 20. Look over at 1 Corinthians chapter 13. Look at verse 1. It's not the same Greek word, but it's the same principle. If I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, did you even know that angels have their own language? Isn't it amazing how Scripture puts those things out there? If I speak with the tongues of men and of angels, but do not have love, what have we become? A noisy gong. We've become a bunch of grumblers, a bunch of complainers. King James Version would say a bunch of murmurers. Not in the translation, but just in the idea. He says, I've become a noisy gong or a clanging cymbal. I mean, how many sounds can a cymbal really make? One. I know you can tap it different ways, but don't take me there. Here's what I want you to think of. What was missing out of that first group? Love. If they had love for those people who came and worked 1 hour, what would their response, how would their response been different? Man, that's great for you guys. But instead of thinking on terms of love, what were they thinking in terms of? Selfishness. Don't I deserve more? Yeah. Right. Maybe not even loving in terms of that relationship. I want you to think real quickly. We're not going to turn over and look at it. I think we know it well enough that we can just appeal to it. And if you want to go back and read it, that's fantastic. In the Old Testament, there's a character who is a perfect example of this, who does the right thing in the end in terms of action, but the heart is missing. And that man's name is Jonah. Now, the first time Jonah is told to go to Nineveh, how does he respond? Opposite direction. And then God has him spit back up by that great fish on the shore, and God tells him the exact same thing again. Go to Nineveh. And this time, what does he do? He goes. But he doesn't want to go because later on he says, because I knew you'd be a forgiving God. I knew you would relent of this destruction that you had for them. And that's why I didn't want to go. He didn't love them. They were his enemies. And yet he went and he preached in Nineveh, and God used him. And the whole city of Nineveh, from top to bottom, repented. He even talks about in sackcloth. Even on down to where they declared a fast that even the animals were not allowed to eat. We talk about how much effort it would take to keep animals from eating. How you would have to take care of those things. They go that far, and God uses Jonah for his purpose. Even though Jonah's heart is detestable through every part of Jonah until you get to perhaps the very end. When in the way that it so abruptly ends, it sounds like, and that's when Jonah got it. And to think, how many people would want to write their own story that's that despicable? If Jonah wrote the book of Jonah, which it certainly sounds that way. And so you realize, what was Jonah missing? He's missing love. And what did he become? A grumbler. He'd become a complainer. He'd become bitter. Even to the point where he's so disgusted, he wants to just sit up on the hill hoping that God will destroy them all. And he's so angry at God. Oh, angry. Is that where you want to be? Now, you notice that, I want you to see the flip side of this. Look over at Philippians chapter 2. Look down at verse 14. We have to make sure we're not like that first group, that we don't go about things the same way. Philippians chapter 2, look at verse 14. And throughout the first 13 verses of chapter 2, it's been all about do nothing out of selfishness or empty conceit. Don't think more highly of yourself than you ought to. He says, but think about others. And then it uses Jesus as the perfect example, who emptied himself, becoming a bondservant, and became obedient to his Father, even to the point of death. And because of that, he's given a name that's above every name in heaven, on earth, and under the earth. He says, and every knee will bow. Then it gets to verse 14. Do all things without grumbling or disputing. Now, what did that first group miss? You notice here he says, do all things without grumbling or disputing. That first group was content all day long to work for what they had agreed to, seemingly. When did they become discontented and grumblers? When they saw other people receive the same payment for not doing the same work. Now, he says, do all things without grumbling or disputing. Verse 15. And what does that prove whenever you live a life like that? He says, so that you will prove yourselves to be blameless and innocent. If we are grumblers and disputers, what does it prove about us? That we are not. We're not blameless and we're not innocent. And the opposite of innocent is guilty. And the opposite of blameless is, it's your fault. You brought it on yourself. Because we have choices, don't we? Now, you can look at the things that God takes care of for other people, and you can just love them and be just so overjoyed for them. Or you can decide what else. You can be jealous. You can be bitter. You can grumble about it. Now, he says, do all things without grumbling or disputing so that you will prove yourselves. It'll be proven. Not prove it to yourself. It just shows who you really are. It shows that you're innocent. It shows that you're blameless. Because think about it. How many times did Jesus grumble and complain and dispute? Now, you're hearing dispute and going, he's standing for truth. He's not disputing people. Then he goes on. He says, children of God, above reproach in the midst of a crooked and perverse generation among whom you appear as lights in the world. What do you think the two characteristics that would show who the crooked and perverse generation is? Grumbling and disputing. Which one are we? We really got to be thinking about this, don't we? Because what happens in the midst, and you've seen it, whether it was you that was the light or whether it was somebody else who was the light, everybody's going through the same difficulties. There's one person here who's not complaining about it. And what's really unique is it's even noticed by those who are in the darkness. You ever been asked, how come you don't complain? How come you're going through all these difficulties, but you don't complain about it? What does that tell you? Is there a contrast? Is it obvious even in the darkness to others? It is. He says, this is how you are above reproach. He says, this is how people will want to know. He says, among whom you appear as lights in the world. And that happens because of verse 16. Holding fast the word of life. Now, I'm going to turn this into a who. Who is the word of life? Jesus. He says, you're going to hold on to Jesus with everything. I'm not going to grumble and dispute. I'm not going to complain and murmur. I'm going to hold on to Jesus. And in doing that, where do I take my complaints? I can pray about it. Help me to learn how to love. Help me to learn how to just trust you. Because what did those last four shifts, what kind of a situation and relationship did they have with the landowner? Whatever is right. I trust that you'll do that. So oftentimes we go, but I want it this way. Well, yeah, that first shift group, they wanted it a certain way too. And they thought that they should get more. But guess what? They had an agreement. Now, if you're going to appeal to God in light of, all right, God, here's what I'm going to promise you. In terms of, I'm going to help these people and you're going to give me eternal life. How do you think that's going to end? He didn't agree to that. Where does his agreement start? You're going to have to hold on to my son. You're going to have to be faithful obedience. Now, you notice how this finishes. Holding fast the word of life, so that in the day of Christ I will have reason to glory, because I did not run in vain nor toil in vain. If we're a bunch of grumblers and disputers, what does it do to our whole lives? The run is all in vain. It is all for nothing. Now, you see this picture, and I want to show you how Jesus really sees this crooked and perverse generation. How he really sees these grumblers, those who want to dispute over all these different things. Because isn't that what they're doing with their grumbling? Isn't that what it led them to want to do with the landowner? Isn't that what their statement is about? We have a dispute with you. And what's Jesus going to, what's the landowner going to say? It's the agreement. You agreed. Now, come back to Matthew chapter 20. So here they are. They've grumbled. They brought this dispute before the landowner. Verse 13. But he answered and said to one of them, look at this first word, friend. Now, I'm going to tell you, there's more than one Greek word in the New Testament for friend. We'll get into that here in a second. Friend, I am doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for a denarius? He says, do you remember 12 hours ago whenever I searched after you to find you and we made an agreement that there would be one denarius between us? And that would be fitting? Notice they don't pipe up and go, yeah. He says, take what is yours and go. Now, I want you to think about that for a second. Take what is yours and go. Where are they about to leave? The vineyard. Where do you want to be? I'd like to stay. He says, but I wish to give to this last man the same as to you. He says, that's my wish. That's what I want to do. I am the landowner. I've honored my agreement with you. Now, back in verse 13, he says, friend. There's a Greek word. It works off of the term for love, phileo. And it's philos is the Greek word for friend, someone you're very tender and compassionate toward. A loving relationship. Now, here's what I want you to hear. That's not this word for friend. This is a different word for friend. It's the same word that Jesus says in Matthew 26 to Judas before he heads out. He says, friend. It's about we have shared together in this time. It's kind of a word like comrade, if that makes sense. Did Judas not share in the work together with the other 11 and with Jesus? He did on the outside, but what was wrong? The inside. What was Judas's big complaint? What was he willing to betray Jesus for? Money. I deserve more. Was everybody taken care of the same? Sure. I want you to notice here, in terms of thinking down those lines of going, did not all the laborers labor in the same vineyard? They were comrades. And he says, but that's as far as it goes. Because what was missing on the inside of those servants, those laborers that were hired early in the morning, was they did not know how to love. They decided they were going to approach this kingdom in light of self. And in the end, where are they sent? Go. I kept my word. I kept my agreement. now. Notice he continues on. In verse 15, he says, is it not lawful for me to do what I wish with what is my own? He says, don't I have a right to what is my own? And then he makes this next statement. Or is your eye envious because I am generous? Now, anybody got a footnote for envious and generous? Evil for envious and good for generous. That's the literal translation of this. He says, or is your eye evil because I am good? Because what he gave to those other laborers in giving them a denarius, what was he really showing them? What's the five-letter word you'd use for that? Starts with a G. Grace? Isn't that what it is? He shows them grace. He says, and because I show them grace, you look at me with an evil eye because you're about you. Notice they don't say anything. Now, I want to show you where we've already been to see this. Look back at Matthew chapter 6. It'll probably make a little bit more sense now. Two verses in the Sermon on the Mount. Matthew chapter 6, look down at verse 22. Jesus has just been talking about, for where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. Verse 22. The eye is the lamp of the body. Now, I want you to think about that just for a second. We know what a lamp is. I want you to see the comparison. Whenever you were young, you walked into a room, there might have been one light bulb in the room. You flip the switch on, light bulb comes on, and now that is the lamp for the whole room. He says, the way you see things with your eyes. And really, what's he talking about? What's in your heart? He's just been talking about, for where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. He says, the eye is the lamp of the body. How you see these things that happen. Because here it is. You think the group that worked an hour and got paid a denarius, how do you think their eyes were? Oh, man, look at what God did for us. We got paid for a whole day's wage and we weren't even here an hour. Oh, I'm so grateful for this landowner. Can I work here tomorrow? Isn't that what it would do to you? Is that what you would want? This is quite a relationship in this kingdom. He says, the eye is the lamp of the body. He says, so then, if your eye is clear. Now, he says, if your eye is clear or healthy, he says, your whole body will be full of light. He says, if you start seeing things spiritually, you start seeing things out of love, what will it do to all these situations? Will it change your point of view? What about the flip side? Verse 23. But if your eye is bad, now, anybody got a footnote for bad? Evil. Isn't that something? If your eye is evil, your whole body will be full of darkness. That first group that was hired, what's inside of them? You know it's not love. Evil. Darkness. And notice, where do they get sent? Go. I gave you what I agreed to. He says, if then the light that is in you is darkness, how great is the darkness? They labored for 12 hours. And yet, what's still the problem? The heart. No love. Now, you think about the application of these things specifically, of going back over here in Matthew chapter 20. So you see when he says, or is your eye evil because I am good? Don't look at somebody else's generosity and go, well, they never did that for me. We ever do that? Karen? Right. And you see how that eye of what he sees really changed the relationship. Lynn? Right. His brother. Yeah, and you think about there in Luke 15, how specific that is of going. I like to call that story the parable of two lost sons. One's lost away and one's lost at home. And to realize he's so angry. And he makes that statement. You're going to do this for him? You never did this for my friends. Huh. Interesting. Angie. Right. And you think too, and that's really where I wanted to go in terms of saying, so often we read through this story, we go, man, it'd be great to be that group that just comes in, works 1 hour and gets paid for the whole day. I'm going to tell you about something that group misses out on that I want you to just be mindful of. If they have just themselves, even if they have families, what are they wondering about all day? How am I going to take care of myself? How am I going to feed myself? How am I going to take care of my family? I don't have this job. Nobody will hire me. I mean, because you notice, what was their statements among some of them? We would have worked, but nobody hired us. A willingness, but not an opportunity. And to go, so often you look at this group, and I go, I'm pretty sure I don't want to be part of the first group. I think everybody reads this story and goes, I don't want to be those folks. But the 9 o'clock group, that's pretty good. 12 o'clock group, that's good. That means I know that I'm going to be taken care of. I don't have to have an agreement of exact things, but to go, I know that I'm going to be taken care of because of the relationship with the landowner and sharing in that relationship together. And to go, here I am. We go through the difficulties. We go through the scorching heat of some days. And I'm using that a little proverbially. And to go, and through the burdens that come through. But you realize, as you go through, you also get the burden of realizing, look at what God's grace has done, even in the midst of this great difficulty. And you get to see the blessing, whereas if you never went through the difficulty, you could never see the blessing that comes with it. That's one of the most marvelous things in 2 Corinthians chapter 1. When it talks about God being the God of all peace, the God of all comfort, and it talks about, for every difficulty that comes in, there's a greater grace that comes in over the top of it. And so many times we get stuck in the burden and we never look for the grace and going, because we're going to be above reproach, because we're going to be blameless and innocent, we're not going to grumble about things and dispute them all the time, but rather go, oh, I just want to be a son of light. I want to be a child of God. Then going, and look at what God does. Because God shows grace to the humble. And the humble are going to work off of love. And you share in this relationship in the kingdom of God together. And we go, here's another one of those comparisons. I want to listen to the foreman. Because who does he get his instruction from? The landowner. And I want to be pleasing. And so you start to see these things together, and then you get to verse 16. So the last shall be first, and the first last. The last get paid first, and the first go away how? Unhappy. Here they were, what they agreed to, and they go away unhappy. And then comes verses 17 through 19. And we're going to cover it just real quickly. And then we're going to come back to it next week, Lord willing. Verse 17. Who's the greatest servant? Who's the servant who started earliest in the morning and worked and bore the burden and the scorching heat of the day and got all the way to the end and finished the day with the right attitude of love and got paid the same thing? Verse 17. As Jesus was about to go up to Jerusalem, he took the 12 disciples aside by themselves. And on the way, he said to them, "Behold, we are going up to Jerusalem, and the Son of Man will be delivered to the chief priests and scribes, and they will condemn him to death, and will hand him over to the Gentiles to mock and scourge and crucify him. And on the third day, he will be raised up." I want you to notice Jesus, specifically at the end. Does he know he's going to be mocked? Does he know he's going to be scourged? Does he know he's going to be crucified? But does he stop at just that thought? What does he also know about? On the third day, I'm going to be raised. He says, and I'm going to put myself last, which that's Philippians 2. And then what is God going to do? He'll make me first. He says, and you know where I'm going to be? Same place you will, in terms of responding faithfully in this kingdom. Now, he's the firstborn, so he gets a double portion. Hallelujah. Only seems fitting. But at the same time to go, I'm going to go and prepare a place for you in my Father's house so that you can dwell with me. Now, you think about those things through and through and see this parable of the vineyard. Of going, there's one thing I know for sure. I don't want to be the first group. Any of the other groups, as long as I can do it out of love. And to realize, I want to be blameless. That's what I want. And that means it's got to control my words and my heart and my mindset and my motives to make sure, am I walking faithfully in the kingdom of heaven? Because who is the king? King Jesus. And he showed us how to be the greatest servant. He took last place so that now he has the first place as king. All right. Lord willing, next week, come back, revisit those verses again. Thank you.